The 2005 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 231, a panel entitled Why We Stay, with Nola Wallace, Fred Christensen, Lori Winder Stromberg, Chase Peterson, and Mary Lithgow Bradford.
I welcome you to this session of Sunstone. This is session number, I never keep them straight. Did I get to that page? Session number 231. It's one that it's become an annual event at Sunstone here. We started some 2 years ago. This will be the third time we've done it. Where we've asked people who have been members of the church for a long period of time, and some longer than others, as you can see, but still. Can you have a hard time hearing me? Back? Can you hear me? I'm sympathetic. Is that better? I'm sympathetic to hearing problems. I've got some of my own. So we started this as a way of hearing the life experience of people who have been involved in the church for decades, a long time, and have dealt with some issues within their own lives about how they relate to the church, how they relate to church members and their involvement with it, and they tell us their story. And I was part of that. The beginning group that started, I see Dorothy Wilkinson here. She was last year, and I suspect there are others out there in the audience. My eyesight was good enough to see you. But we welcome you today. We will start, and we will go in the order as we have it here on the program. Our first presenter will be Nola Wallace, who has been a longtime Sunstone attender. She and her husband were always here. Her husband passed away during the past year, and he was always involved in presenting here in down Southern California and doing a lot of other things like that. Following her will be Fred Christensen, who's a retired neurosurgeon from Arizona, Phoenix, Scottsdale, Paradise Valley, I guess, if you get to break it down those areas like that. He practiced neurosurgeon for a long time, and is now involved in some community efforts of teaching English people Spanish speaking people how to speak English. He's also put a lot of time in writing a biography, which I just finished reading, which very, very interesting. Sort of the Confessions of a Neurosurgeon, and I would say is a real lesson in the shortcomings of neurosurgery, too, as seen from the inside. A very recognizable, I think, experience for probably anybody who's been in professions that realize we ain't as good as we thought we were going to be when we went into them. Following Fred will be Lori Winder Stromberg, who has been involved in Mormon Women's Forum, and coming to Sunstone longer than I have. And she's with us. We certainly appreciate her being here. I wasn't sure she was going to be here. Her mother passed away this week, and they had their funeral services yesterday, but we're delighted to have Lori with us. Our fourth speaker is Chase Peterson, who is known to most of us. He was president of the University of Utah. He was a dean at Harvard University and also a physician himself, which is a very interesting background to bring to a situation like where we are now. And finally, the last one is the inimitable Mary Lithgow Bradford, who has been involved in Mormons issues since she and I were seniors at the University of Utah. I didn't know what they were then, but she did. And she's been fighting that battle ever since that time. She was editor of Dialogue and has been involved here at Sunstone for a long time. So we'll proceed in that order, and if there's time afterwards, why we'll entertain questions, although we'll just have to see how that goes. So, Nola, if you'd come first.
Why I stay? Why do I stay? The short answer is that I was born here, and that makes a difference. Maternal grandfather pulled a handcart across the plains, was involved in establishing the primary organization, and was a state patriarch. Parents were married in the Salt Lake Temple, as I was. Such is my provenance. Mormonness is my condition of being. It has shaped my ethics, my standards of behavior. At times, Mormonness was mediated through my Danish mother, who could, as with a stun gun, stop my rationalization of a misdeed with a look from steel gray eyes and the words, "But you know better." As I grew older, I discovered that the LDS coin has a flip side, and there were questions to which I could find no intellectually respectable answers. I had been fortunate. In my particular part of Zion, discussion and questioning of religious concepts had been usually seen not as incipient apostasy, but as a stage in religious growth. Agency and ecclesiastical authority have historically always hung in the balance in the church. But now, has obedience become the first law of heaven despite Jesus declaring that love of God and of neighbor are primary? And does race and or gender really have to do with priesthood? Why are men seen as leaders and women only ancillary when presumably all are in the image of God? Then 12 years ago, some upper echelons of my own particular Christian soldiers began marching as to war, and were not, in my opinion, following their own written rules of engagement. While I was in the periphery and not a direct target, friends of mine were victims of their presumably friendly fire. I and many others were merely collateral damage. Post-traumatic shock is not a comfortable condition, and after the white roses were wielded and the signed petitions had doubtlessly been deposited with the obviously appropriate committee, I bound up my wounds and began to search the scriptures, as all are exhorted to do, in order to understand what had transpired. As in many scripture searches, mine had elements of proof texting, scouring scripture for quotations to back my previously arrived at conclusions. Sorrowing comments from Liberty Jail in 1839, as found in the Doctrine and Covenants, came to mind. Quote, "We have learned by sad experience that it is the nature and disposition of almost all men, as soon as they get a little authority, as they suppose, they will immediately begin to exercise unrighteous dominion." End of quote. But a scripture from an older testament seemed even more appropriate, one which had often quieted my soul in times of trouble and helped to restore emotional equilibrium. "Be still and know that I am God." This scripture and the ones about asking in order to receive and knocking in order that the door be opened seemed a directive to go to the source, that most immediate and relevant of contacts with the divine, or to strengthen in weakness and bring solace in sorrow. I had in special circumstance felt guided past the limits of my skills as a sculptor. I have known the sense of being a conduit to give comfort when I sang at a funeral. So I turned away from Wasatch Front issues and prayed long and earnestly. At length I sensed a kind of answer. "Stop tormenting yourself. All is not correct yet. We will keep sending, and in time all will be rightly understood." President Hinckley had said that there are problems in the church. If there are problems in the church, they are related to growth. And I began to think about that and to study what happens as organizations increase in size. The history of institutions suggests that whatever their purpose or origin, secular or ecclesiastical, rapid change and increased size leads almost inexorably to increased central control in an attempt to maintain equilibrium and identity. Central control requires increased central power. Lord Acton, writing in 1887, said, "Power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Can one envision a power more absolute in the minds of many church members than ecclesiastical power, since it claims jurisdiction beyond the grave and into eternity? In her insightful essay, The Ambiguous Gift of Obedience, Levina Fielding Anderson reminds us that we, quote, need to accept that much of the functioning of the church is the functioning of a bureaucracy. Why then, she asks, should we be surprised when it acts like a bureaucracy? She is right, I think. We tend to forget that church leaders, however much we may respect them, are only prophets when they are acting as prophets. If we make of them idols and blindly follow, we not only are attempting to avoid responsibility for our own actions, but are, to quote from a Brigham Young discourse, quote, trusting our eternal destiny in the hands of our leaders with a reckless confidence that in itself would thwart the purposes of God in our salvation and weaken the influence we could give our leaders. Yes, he did say that, although I haven't heard it quoted very frequently. Martin J. Murray, called by some the Dean of American Religious History, says that no people, agency, institution, nation, or cultural entity can resist idolatry, self-idolization, unless there is pressure and motive to engage in self-examination. I can't point to an institution in world history that renews itself unless there is a built-in mechanism for calling things into question. I believe that the church is beginning to develop such a mechanism. I have in my possession a copy of a speech given by a stake president to a special meeting in Boise, Idaho, about a month ago. The subject was how to improve relationships with non-members. Based on a survey of 600 residents and 8 focus groups in Idaho, it had been found that, quote, a substantial proportion of non-members in Idaho feel that members, 1, judge them to be inferior, 2, make them feel excluded, 3, focus their interactions on converting them rather than creating and sustaining friendships, and 4, use political influence to impose their perspectives on them. The paper, among other things, recommends that we acknowledge that there is a problem and accept our share of the responsibility rather than excusing ourselves, and that in our interactions with non-members, we not assume that we have all the teachings and none of the learning to do. I quote. In June 2000, Gary Walker, acting on assignment from Salt Lake, served as the LDS representative to a panel discussion at the Association of Idaho Cities Conference in Coeur d'Alene. The panel was part of the conference theme on human rights. Representatives from the major faith traditions in Idaho explained to the audience how their religion taught them the importance of treating everyone with dignity and respect. Under direction from Elder Marlon K. Jensen, Gary Walker said, "We know that we have sometimes been cliquish and appear to be exclusive. We know that part of the responsibility for any strains that are between LDS and non-LDS people is ours. We apologize for creating part of the problem and want to go on record as being willing and very determined to do all that we can to improve the relationships between LDS and non-LDS members of our communities," end of quote. I think it is a very good beginning and hope that it continues and accelerates. So much for the macrocosm. What of the microcosm, the word? I found this to be quite another story. The membership is smaller, the leaders know the members individually, and since church callings are limited as to term, the members know how the leaders behave when they are not leaders. In my particular rural ward in Idaho, I relearned the power and supportive love of community, particularly in a crisis situation. My husband of 59 years was dying after a year's struggle with the after effects of a stroke. We were a mile from the closest neighbor, 7 miles from the nearest little town, and 40 miles from the hospital. Every time an ambulance arrived, the bishop's car was not far behind. There is an eerily efficient grapevine in a rural setting. This is where the spiritual becomes manifest in the sociological, and this is a good reason to stay. The core concepts revealed by Joseph Smith are extraordinary. LDS faith envisions necessary and non-contingent existence, not subject to whimsical divine erasure. It posits each life essentially uncreated by and co-eternal with a God whose glory is intelligence and who says, "Come, let us reason together." Our LDS faith offers limitless opportunity to progress and mandates that we learn from an exhaustive curriculum the how and when, as well as the who and why of creation. Though we can see only through a glass darkly, who would not want to stay and see if or when that revolutionary vision will actually be implemented. Thank you.
Toby, thank you for inviting me to this testimony meeting. My remarks I wouldn't be able to give in my own ward, so it's nice to be far enough from home that I can speak these things. By introduction, I also am a fifth generation member of the church, and it would be easy to say that I stay because it's the comfortable position to be in. But that's not true. My remarks have been prepared over the last 50 years as I've struggled with issues and somehow to relate my faith to my profession. One day in medical school, Hillman Castle went down the roll, stopped his finger, said, "Christensen, the man comes in, he's got swelling of his ankles. He's having a hard time breathing, he's out of breath, he's tired. What's wrong with him?" "Well, this is my chance to shine," I said. "He's in congestive heart failure." Castle said, Castle was an old bomber pilot from World War II. He said, "That's like dropping your bombs from 50,000 feet, he says. Everything looks like the enemy at that distance. He says, get down around 5,000 and you just wiped out a convoy of school children and school buses." And he went on down and he said, "Bishop, give him a differential diagnosis." So the difference in medicine and the hierarchical approach of the church was that there isn't a right answer, there is a more probable answer, and you never know what the right answer is. But you proceed based on the most probable answer. When I finished my residency and came back to Arizona, I was asked to teach the gospel doctrine class, and I used that same technique. I would present the manual lessons with a Socratic approach, I suppose, but with the non-conclusion that is usual in the manual. And I got by with that for about a year and a half before they decided that I was too much of a liability. But I wasn't running for apostle, so I didn't really care. And I was shuffled into teaching the young unmarrieds, and that was a fun experience. And then I was asked to teach the high priest group, which I did for a number of years. There were endless complaints from the fundamentalists. But it's hard to be demoted once you're a high priest, and so I didn't really care either. And finally they said, you know, we really wish you would be the group leader of the high priest, but there's one provision. You can't teach the class any longer. What I'm going to do in this brief time is try to go down some of the issues in conflict with science and medicine and religion. And I hope they're not too disquieting, but I'll tell you how I resolve them and how I've dealt with them and why I remain a faithful member of the church. Usually in testimony meeting, I take something and to read, but I didn't think it would be appropriate here today. Let's talk first about the healing power of the priesthood. If you read the Bible, you get the impression that disease was possession of a demon. Seizures, schizophrenia, this was possession of devils, and they had to be cast out. Doctors were not very effective at the time of Joseph Smith, at the time of Brigham Young, and of course it was a matter of lack of faith to consult the medical profession. You had to go to the elders to be administered to. My background, because I remember well the enema bag, and maybe some of you still do, where purgatives were used. You see, I'm still in the era prior to penicillin. Infectious disease wasn't very treatable in my very early youth, in the 1930s. And doctors oftentimes did more harm than they did good. One day, while in medical school, I was asked to go down to LDS Hospital as part of my elders' quorum duties. We picked up the name of those who wanted a blessing. I went into the room, and here was a man on a striker frame. He was quadriplegic. And he'd been quadriplegic for a year. And he had full faith that somehow we were going to heal him from this awful condition that had been thrust upon him from an accident. Well, now there's the test. I knew very well that nothing was going to reverse this. So what do you do? I said, I would rather anoint with oil and have you administer to this man. In my 30-year professional history, I have never seen anybody cured from an incurable problem by the power of the priesthood. I've seen cases where those persons would have no way of knowing that they were not cured, and I go into that a little bit in the biography, but they weren't. So why do I still believe in the power of the priesthood? Well, disease and getting well from disease is more than sewing up and taking out things. Our mental attitude has a great deal to do with how long we live, our blood pressure, our healing of wounds. I had a patient not too many years ago who had an incurable cancer that was invading the nerves to his leg. And as they destroyed the nerves, the pain was intolerable. He was administered to by the elders, and he had absolute pain relief for about 2 weeks. And then, of course, it came back. But he had 2 weeks of pain relief through the administration of the priesthood. We know that the mental attitudes have a great deal to do with the control of pain. And I think if I can administer to someone and give them a feeling of optimism, a feeling of security, that physically benefits their getting well. So I found a little different role. I don't cast out devils anymore. I bless them with a feeling of security. The Book of Mormon was an issue with me long before DNA. I didn't quite understand how Jules Verne submarines with a hole in the top and the bottom could possibly carry people. I didn't understand why there were no archaeological remains of this rather large society. I didn't understand how doubling times would possibly explain. Well, you can go on and on. At any rate, I didn't think as much as 30 years ago that the Book of Mormon was a historical record, and I think the nail on the coffin is probably DNA. Now, I know there are those Cinderella slipper people who want to talk about limited geography. You understand Cinderella slipper. They say it fits just fine. All you got to do is cut off the big toe and trim the heel down a little, and it all works out. But I continue to believe the Book of Mormon, and I believe it is a revelation from God. And the reasoning here takes a little more time than I have available, but it goes something like this. We are best defined by the myths that we believe, not our actions. They all fall short. None of us live up to what we want. It's what we believe in, what we strive for, what we idealize. And the Book of Mormon is a book of wonderful ideals. It's got some political assassination and a few things in there that maybe aren't too good too. But for the main, it's a wonderful guide of how we should conduct our lives. And I would like it as part of my mythology. And I will follow it for that reason. And I think it represents the teachings of Jesus and of the God that I believe in. You know, it's interesting coming back to Salt Lake, not having lived here for over 30, 40 years, I guess. And I drive up 33rd South, and Kissel's Barbershop isn't there anymore. The Fix-It Shop's gone. There's a emissions testing center there. And worst of all, I drove up by my old house and the Burbage House, and it wasn't there. It's gone. They scraped it. Nobody understood that my father walked to work for years to buy that house for us. Well, you have to accept change. It was a horrible emotional feeling to see the house gone. The only thing that's sure in life is change. We're working on taxes and death. We're going to get rid of them someday also. But we won't get rid of change. So when I find that my great aunt, who we had Thanksgiving dinner with each year, a polygamous wife, whose whole life was to try to live this eternal marriage principle, that principle is now looked at as a basis of excommunication in the church. When I find my other great-great-grandfather, who went to Southern Utah in the United Order, struggled for years to make it work, and I was taught as a child that communal property would finally be the system that we had to live in. It's never even mentioned anymore. These are the fundamental doctrines that distinguish the Latter-day Saints. We were the chosen. What were there? 800,000 of us in a billion world population, but somehow we were exceptional. I think that were Rip Van Winkle a member of the church in 1850, and he came back today to Salt Lake, he would say, this has nothing to do with the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And it worries many people that we have change in the church, whether it be the design of garments or the temple ordinance or whatever. But I look upon it just the opposite. It's social Darwinism, and if we can't change, we will simply extinct sooner or later. It's a necessary part of the church. And sometimes I'm disturbed that it takes so long to change ideas, whether it be family planning or gender issues in the church. But I think that the church is necessary as a leveling influence and shouldn't be in the forefront of change. So I don't look upon change as a negative aspect of the church. I think it's a very positive factor, who didn't have some problems of one form or another. But do you know what they all had in common? They're all trying to be better people. Now, who wouldn't want to associate with an organization where the primary goal is to be better people? And contrast that with the other zealotry who didn't have some problems of one form or another. Now, these are the reasons that I stay active in the church, and sometimes it's not pleasant to go and hear the same lessons that I've heard maybe 1,000 times over again. And I wouldn't hear those boys.
I think I had my first hot flash while I was out in the hall, and so maybe I do belong on this panel. When Toby Pingree called and asked me to be on a panel titled, actually he told me it was Why I Stay, my initial reaction was, I'm not entirely sure I have. For me, Toby's statement brought more questions than assertions. These questions, however, there are two things you need to know about me in order to understand what follows. First, I've been a Mormon feminist activist for over 30 years. I saw a cousin yesterday who's an area authority and has recently returned to the States. He reminded me of a conversation we had at a family party several years ago where we were talking and he said, I wish I was your bishop. And I said to him, I wish I was yours. I date my feminism from 1973 when I was invited by a BYU family home evening sister to attend a meeting of the Utah Valley chapter of the Women's Political Caucus. The discussion focused on the Equal Rights Amendment, which had passed Congress in 1972 and was being ratified by the states. I was converted. However, it took me a few years to transfer my newfound feminist sensibilities from the secular to the religious arena. When the LDS Church came out against the ELA, I initially questioned my commitment to the controversial amendment. However, examining all the arguments, I decided I could not in good conscience adopt the Church's position on this issue. This process freed me to question other issues, beliefs, and practices, including the Church's patriarchal underpinnings. After 30 years of activism, I'm feeling pretty tired and cynical. It saddens me that we're still talking about the same issues. How can women have a voice in a patriarchal institution? How do we combat sexual abuse in a church where all men are seen as possessing a spiritual authority women don't have? How do we deal with the schizophrenic messages that tell us men ought to preside over their families, but also see their wives as partners? How do we live with the disconnect between sharing equal status with male co-workers in the secular sphere and taking a back seat at church? How do we justify remaining part of an institution that encourages women to participate in their own subordination? Where is God the Mother in all of this? Years ago, I predicted that if the LDS Church didn't abandon patriarchy, ordain women, and integrate them into its power structure, it would lose a generation or more of bright young women and some older ones who valued their Mormonism but were tired of waiting. As the gap between church norms and societal norms for women grew, I opined, many women would leave and we would be left predominantly with a female membership that was frustrated and depressed and didn't know why, or more conservative and thus more accepting of the status quo. In the words of one such older feminist, an electronic friend, an email friend, those of us who really cared to do something, who were angry and in pain about the way women were treated in the church, eventually saw that even our collective efforts were useless against a culture that was becoming more and not less oppressive. In order to handle the dissonance, we disengaged and at some point stopped caring about the church as an institution. We're disinvested. Second, I've struggled with belief all of my life. I'm a fourth-generation Mormon with strong pioneer roots and expectations. As a child, I asked questions in church with the fundamental assumption that a given principle or practice was true, but I wanted to know why or how it was true. I have long since abandoned that foundational assumption, in part because of what I described above. At some point in my life, I began sorting through the various doctrines and beliefs I encountered and placing them into one of five categories. One, those things I know to be true. Two, those things I believe to be true. Three, those things I don't believe to be true but am open to believing. Four, those things I don't believe to be true and am not open to. Five, those things I know not to be true. As far as I can remember, I did not then, nor do I now, assign any belief to either the first or fifth categories, namely those things I know to be true or untrue, as John McLaughlin would say, with absolute metaphysical certainty. While there were a few things in the fourth category, things I don't believe and am not open to believing, such as the divine origin of the patriarchal order, I struggled primarily with those doctrines and principles of the church that I either believed or was open to believing. Now I'm far more tentative in my beliefs than I was then. Needless to say, I am not a mystic. A book published recently might illuminate my struggle. It's called The God Gene by Dean H. Hamer, a geneticist at the National Cancer Institute. The book deals with the role genes play in religious belief. Hamer looked at the DNA samples of several of his subjects, hoping to find variants of genes that tended to turn up in what he calls self-transcendent people. His search led him to a gene known as VMAT2. Two different versions of this gene exist, differing only at a single position. People with one version of the gene tend to score a little higher on the self-transcendence tests. Although their influence is small, it is, Hamer claims, consistent. About half the people in the study had at least one copy of this self-transcendent boosting version of VMAT2, which Hamer dubs the God gene. Aha! Is it possible that some people are genetically predisposed to belief and others, like me, are not? Well, as the Scientific American Review of Hamer's book states, the role that genes play in religion is a fascinating question that's ripe for the asking, but Hamer is a long way from providing the answer. No definitive answer here. However, among my friends, the phrase, "you obviously lack the God gene," has become a playful way of responding to my skepticism. Aside from feminist issues, I think what I've most struggled with is traditional notions of worship and authority. I've always been troubled by the notion that we are fawning underlings to a God who demands our devotion. Bob Reese, do you remember the discussion we had about this? My feminist sensibilities set me up to be suspicious of traditional power structures, particularly patriarchal ones. I've never been comfortable with adoring personal relationships either. I don't want to be adored, and I can't believe in a God who would even appreciate, let alone expect, our adoration. So, given the above, is there a place in Mormonism for me? A couple of days after I agreed to do this panel, it was my birthday. So, feeling slightly self-indulgent, I sent the following email to some of my friends who, I should add, are amazingly patient, insightful, and articulate. I just got a call a few days ago asking me to do a panel at Sunstone titled Why I Stay. The problem is I'm not sure I have. What does it mean to stay? Is there a qualifying bottom line in terms of church activity, belief, and or identification with Mormonism? And if so, what is it? Well, I'm interested in your thoughts on the questions above. It's my birthday, and I'm allowed a certain amount of self-indulgence. I thought it might be fun to ask you the following. Do I meet the bottom line, if there is one? Have I stayed? And if so, why do you think I have? If not, why not? Knowing all of you, I reserve the right to edit for taste. So I'd like to read some of the responses I received, because returning to my initial assertion, they reveal how fluid the notion of staying really is. Here's the first, and this is where I can cut. I'm sorry, because of the events of the past week, I wasn't able to edit this, so I don't know how long it is. Okay. I think that staying is defined differently by the community than by us as individuals. Lori, perception of participation is what counts for the community, beginning with the so-called part member families who, no matter how engaged the head of the household may be, are usually seen as participating only part way. The idea of staying is much more elastic and invisible when we define it individually. For me, it's like a relationship with a person. You know in your heart when you've exited, even though all outward signs of engagement may seem the same. Our only study president, whom I love, recently asked me when I was coming back to church. I laughed. What would that be like? In some ways, it would be easier because I'm disinvested. I would be like an anthropological participant observer, physically present but disengaged from the shared priorities, values, beliefs. The Mormon Corporation is schizophrenic. It professes to be a community of belief and yet perception of faithfulness is based on behavior. This means as long as our outward performance is consistent with expectations, we can pass for faithful as long as we don't express a contrasting opinion. Here's another. Hey, Lori, I thought the comment was... I believe that it would be possible for the corporation to get in line with Mormonism's potentially liberating theology. Now that I've completely given up hope for organizational diversity and inclusion, I can afford to be a disinterested and silent observer. The less invested I am, the better able I am to assume the dispassionate, unemotional stance. There is a point in the disengagement process when commitment and perspective balance most effectively. It is the point at which an individual still cares enough to advocate for change, but no longer cares enough to find excommunication a threat. That is a powerful stance. And another. I stay because I hope. I hope the institution will get better. Here's another. I think the technical church handbook definition of staying is attending sacrament meeting at least once a month. In that sense, you are active, I think. I am too, technically. I also think that defining yourself as a Mormon or a member of the church is directly related to having been baptized and having your name on the records of the church. If you haven't been dipped, you aren't a Mormon, no matter what you believe. Then there is the category of people who do not want to remove their name from the church records for whatever reason. I'm going to cut here. I like how Peter Ashcraft put it one time when responding to this question. He said he felt that he was not active anymore, but that Mormons are his people, we are his tribe. I like the tribe analogy, and it fits in my head. Tribes are not all like-minded people, nor do they share a complete set of common goals, but they have a history of common experience, and they support one another in many small but meaningful ways, and it gives them an identity, even if they wear it uncomfortably. So I would say that I am uncomfortable in the large tribe of Mormonism, but it is my tribe and I have chosen it. And I like the subset in the tribe with whom I choose to identify. If I did not have that little subgroup, I doubt I would be active, but I would still be a member on the books. Here's another one from Albert Peck. The way I engage others in the world is very Mormon. That Mormon Christian approach to others and the world is perhaps, in the world is perhaps permanently imprinted in the hardware of my being, and I am glad for that. While the values aren't uniquely Mormon, the metaphors, the vocabulary I use to articulate and understand them are very Mormon, and I like that too. And when I thought about all that, somehow all the Mormon behavioral and even the belief stuff seemed like superficial froth on top of a notion of Mormon commonality. And then I felt even more Mormon. Usually it doesn't bother me that Orthodox Mormons see me otherwise. I still feel we're on the same side. In fact, the thing I most hate about going to church, even more than boredom, which is great, is how, as I listen to the lectures, my mind is nonstop replying, "I don't believe that." And I really don't believe that. But I don't like that experience of exaggerating the split. So I prefer to journey separate with the myth of commonality intact rather than be together and feel separate. Here's one from an Australian friend. I like your question, and ever being the slippery relativist pomo, I guess it all depends on where you stand on the issue. Most active Mormons would consider you out. But active Mormonism encourages black and white thinking. Probably disaffected Mormons would consider you in with varying qualifications. Most non-Mormons wouldn't have a clue and would be guided by your own explanation. I guess I think we all stay with identities, narratives, cultures, whatever, to the extent that we choose to define ourselves by or in relation to the idea, whatever it is, and whoever defines it. Then again, perhaps it's easier to define ourselves by what we are not. Well, Lori, you are not Mormon. So I suppose that leaves it wide open. If I step out of slippery diplomatic Poe mode and speak from my own experience of you, I would consider you one of the most loyal cultural Mormons I have ever met, have the pleasure of knowing. You have remained interested and connected to a culture that has provided the setting for your formative life. To that extent, I'd give you 7 out of 10 for cultural connectedness. I'd also give you bonus points for hanging in there so tenaciously with people who probably are mostly infuriated by you. That said, you'd score 0 for belief connectedness. Well, maybe 1. And this one from Stacy Burton. I think you've neither stayed nor left. The analogy is faulty. It suggests that Mormonism is fixed, individuals mobile. It also suggests that one is not in or out. Nope, it's more complicated than that. You're not orthodox, intellectual, or in everyday practice, and you're not mystically inclined. But something about Mormonism continues to interest and animate you. Enough that I'd say your connection is more than one of familiarity and history. Down deep, there's a residue of years of working and hoping for an egalitarian, enlightened Mormonism. Were that hope somehow surreally, impossibly to be realized, I don't know what you'd do. Perhaps you'd find it engaging and meaningful and join in. Perhaps not. You and Mormonism coincide on occasion, but not often. Your score on sins of omission is fairly high, but your score on sins of commission is not. Not having acquired enough conspicuous vices to appear gone, you may have the impression of having stayed, more or less. And finally, this from Mary Ellen Robertson. Where are you actually positioned where the church is concerned? The way I see it, you've stayed, at least in the lobby or in the balcony of your ward building. I love the balcony in the ward building behind the temple in Los Angeles. Every chapel should have one. And you stay enough to participate in Sunstone and be interested in the sociocultural aspects of Mormonism and how Mos are perceived, written about, and acted upon. To which I responded, thanks for humoring me, Marianne. I like your idea of positioning, both physically and intellectually. In many ways, my intellectual movement to the fringes of Mormonism has been accompanied by my physical movement from the classroom to the foyer, from the chapel pews to the balcony. And Mary Ellen's response. At what point does one become a parking lot? Technically a church, but not inside. Extending Mary Ellen's terminology, is it possible to be a stay-at-home Mormon? Or, as Stacy Burton suggested, a mall Mormon? While this thread was playful, the question of positioning is at the core of our discussion. So where do I position myself? More importantly, what do I believe? And is it enough to make me Mormon? According to my friend Kathy Stokes, I remain Mormon because I have nowhere else to go. This sounds pathetic, but it might be true. Let me explain. The following is from an essay I published last year in Sunstone entitled Power Hungry. This is the end. 2 more paragraphs. UCLA professor and first century scholar Scott Barchi gave a presentation at Sunstone in which he declared that Christ came to overthrow traditional models of power, which were based on dominance, coercion, and control. In its place, he offered a model of power in which power is only used to empower. Power used to coerce or dominate will always burn itself out. Only power used to empower, says Barchi, is everlasting. This is the single most important insight of my adult life. It is also completely compatible with my understanding of the Mormon doctrine of deity. As I said before, I've always had trouble with traditional notions of worship. The idea that we are fawning underlings to a God who demands our adoration and insists that we conform to his will. It seems to me that the most compelling aspect of Mormonism is the concept of a God, both male and female, who wants peers, of a God who actually longs to share power, of a God who can be changed and even enriched by our existence. Otherwise, what's the point? This is perhaps the one part of Mormonism that compels me, that, despite woefully lacking the God gene, keeps me hooked.
What will the result be of this session? Will you all be asked to vote for this point of view, this point of view, or the others which was the right presentation today, or will none of us share with us or with you what the right presentation is, or will it be a mosaic? And I hope you will join with me in letting this be a mosaic. Why we stay? Why wouldn't we? I believe very much in God and in His Son, Jesus Christ. And I have a personal relationship with divinity that works for me, inspires me, guides me, and comforts me. That relationship is facilitated by my organized religion. Most of the time it is advanced by it, but certainly not always. Are we to draw up some equation balancing benefits and problems and draw a conclusion? Not so easy. Not so rational. Let me try a quick listing of the pluses of my faith. The gospel of Christ is breathtaking in itself, but it is a gospel that must be exercised in the real world with real people. Monasteries must have their value, but neither Christ nor most of us live a monastic life. Once we have a community of human concerns, we enter into facilitated spirituality. My ward fasted for our grandson Charlie, who had a relentlessly progressive, rare, genetic-based muscular paralysis. The effort could be said to have failed. Charlie died. But he died in the virtual arms of hundreds of saints who cared for him, and his parents and grandparents experienced a oneness of life and mortal death and a oneness of caring spirits. 2, eternal progression individually and as a church. Is my progress always quick enough? No. I can be stubborn, deaf, and blind to new truth, and growing just takes time sometimes. Does the church always progress quickly enough for some of us? Could the church have acted sooner with the extension of priesthood to all worthy males? That sort of learning, not surprisingly, takes as much reconditioning and prayer and re-prayer for an organization as it does at times my individual growth. I could be wrong, of course, but I suspect we are painfully working through the phenomenon of same-sex relationships in the same manner, the same for the evolving role of women in the church. But eternal progression individually and as a church is dramatically powerful and optimistic and full of Christ's love. The church surely can be seen as both very cautious and very radical. Think of the Catholic Church holding on to doctrines established 1,500 years ago, totally out of tune with the AIDS epidemic in Africa. The church surely can be seen as both very cautious and very radical by its critics and supporters. I value its capacity and my own to grow with revelation and inspiration. 3, free agency. That cumbersome, eruptive, essential human capacity frees me to own my faith and my spiritual adventures. 4, local lay participation in wards kept small enough to make everyone buy in, participate, and experience callings. It is a brilliant 19th century application of today's best Harvard Business School philosophy, or call what school you will. My participation has invariably helped me grow as well as contribute. Direct access to God, 5, direct access to God and spirituality through prayer, the Holy Ghost, and personal interpretation of Scripture without priestly, read that bureaucratic, without priestly intercession. I have my own spirituality. I am my own prophet. My heritage, 6, that is as tangible and valued as any inheritance could be. I grew up a loyal Mormon boy and became a simultaneously independent, grateful, and loyal adult. independent with respect to every belief and tenet of faith I live by, independent, grateful for a community of saints who challenge, support, and occasionally irritate me productively, and loyal to all I can be loyal to on the battlefield of ideas and systems. This perpetual balancing of duty to my individuality and duty to the collective will never be solved or softened, but I have been helped by a small number of people, ideas, and situations that I now offer with appreciation and in the hope they might help others. My parents never smothered me, nor let the church smother. Item 1, a boy age 11, attending a rigid, unloving sermon at state conference. My older sister bristled. My mother smiled and said, "Well, I don't think I needed that, but likely someone did." Item 2, my father taught Sunday school and priesthood classes most of his life in Logan. He came home one Sunday with a smile on his face and a tear in his eye. Chase never dismissed the dignity and sense of personal responsibility that this wonderful church gives to its members. Before I could start today's lesson, Brother Jones stood up and said, "Brother Peterson, I've thought and prayed about our discussion last week on the topic of such and such, and I've decided the Lord was right." My father went on to ask rhetorically, "Was this some spiritual arrogance or pomposity to presume to judge God?" Perhaps, but it was even more the statement of a man making the eternities his own. Never dismiss the dignity of the personal authority of such a man or the church that prompted him. That man was not a philosopher. He was the janitor of a local bank. Item 3. At age 15, I went away to prep school in New England on an unexpected scholarship. I was writing letters back and forth. My mother wrote that she felt free to share bits of what she perceived as wisdom that she came across as long as I was free to accept or reject them for myself and not hold her responsible. I can see a yellow pad on her knee saying, "Well, now I've said that, and now it's not my worry anymore." One such was a quote from Albert Schweitzer, the theologian, physician, and organist. Speaking of the interplay of faith and reason, he said, and I paraphrase, "When faced with a difficult problem, one must first, study it from every side and by every means available. Then quiet the mind, pray, and await the insight for which thought and prayer have prepared you." Oh, that our conspicuously prayerful national president would do both, as I might add. And, as I might add, as prayer mails. Am I making that clear? He studied and studied and studied and prayed and prayed and prayed. He did not wait for a bolt to knock him off a camel on the way to Damascus. Item 4. Leaving Logan as I did at age 15 and remaining in New England for 15 years, I was usually the only Mormon many of my friends or colleagues knew. I felt I was Brigham Young going east in terms of carrying a mantle of religion, familial, and cultural responsibility. Under these circumstances, if I indulged in teenage rebellion, it was a revolt into orthodoxy. Not only did this prompt loyalty to my church, but looking backwards, I now realize that my singularity permitted me to define what being a Mormon was to my many Gentile colleagues. The Mormon church, such friends and colleagues knew, was largely the church they saw in me. I thought of this recently when a friend told me of the disaffection from the church her children suffered in an Eastern high school when an archly conservative and socially inexperienced family moved into their ward in high school. Two of the daughters of the new family proceeded to walk the halls of their high school in granny dresses, scriptures in hand, stopping classmates at random as if tracting. Not surprisingly, they were ridiculed and caused the practices of the church to be tarred with the image of social disassociation, clumsiness, and insensitivity more firmly and destructively than my friends' children could rebalance or abide. The church my New England friends saw was a culturally and socially positive force, as well as a spiritual force in my life and in the life of a mixed community. Item 5, finally. I exercised basic prayer successfully as a college student and since. Last year, I did so in the context of the neuroanatomy of prayer. Science has discovered that we grow and remold, reconnect, extend our connections in our brain constantly. And until the day we die, we may lose some brain over here because of lack of blood supply over there. The rest of the brain continues to grow daily. What promotes productive remodeling? Hard, optimistic, inventive, charitable thinking. What is a better example of good thinking than prayer, inspired and guided by Christ on a topic of importance? And finally, if prayer has this power, and I am convinced it has, why not pray constantly? Constantly. I mean 10 to 20 times a day or more, as conversation, as meditation, as well as formal and informal prayer. Our brains are listening and growing. These comments have taken me from a lad in Logan to a grateful husband, to Greta and father of wonderful children and grandchildren, and to semi-retirement as an active teacher of medical students. The students seem to get me, and I certainly get them, and both their brains and mine rejoice in our combined continued growth. Call it neuroanatomy or call it spirituality. I call it both and one and the same. This odyssey was aided and secured by my church and my ever-changing faith. I am grateful for that process and can recommend it to my children and grandchildren with neither smothering nor smugness, with neither blind faith nor blind rejection, with intense individuality and free agency, and with growing appreciation for my historic and current debt to many good church leaders and to my fellow saints. I choose to stay.
Can you see me? Well, I feel like the last speaker in sacrament meeting. Everything's been the same subject and everything's been said. But I'll go ahead and give my take on it anyway. I think I will begin at the point where Bob Reese left off when he delivered his Why I Stay speech last year. In the Gospel of John, Christ, seeing his disciples begin to abandon him, asked his chosen 12, "Wilt thou go away?" Peter responds, "Lord, to whom shall we go? Thou hast the words of eternal life." Asked why I stay, my response is, first of all, like some of you, where will I go? The church is my village, my home, my family. I attended another church while staying in Iries, a little village in Southwest Ireland, for several months over a three-year period. This Catholic congregation welcomed me, even asked me to sing in the choir, and I can't sing. When one of the bachelor farmers complimented me for my clean living, no drinking or smoking, he added that he himself had never touched a drink. He recited the pledge he took as a 12-year-old. I replied that I too had taken a pledge. It was called the Word of Wisdom. I recited a few lines for him. I enjoyed going to church there, especially since the meeting was only about 45 minutes long. And time for contemplation, the Lord's Prayer, and some good thoughts. The priest seemed to be like an Irish Brother Benyon for his emphasis on service. And when I left there, he gave me a blessing. He crossed himself, laid his hands on my head, and said, "I bless you that you will always have the Spirit of Christ in your life." These experiences did not serve to convert me to the Catholic Church, however. I, like Mike Quinn, am a DNA woman. And I like the discussion of the genes. The church belongs to me and I to it. I don't intend to leave it. Sometimes I get the feeling that the church is leaving me, but I intend to stick around. I'm comforted by the thought that the church structure, as we know it, is but a temporal one. But I still need it. I still need a structure. I might not need as many strictures, but most of all, I need is people. In the journey that is my life, and most amazing friends and family have succored me, advised me, and nourished me. I wish I could stand here and tell you about every one of them. There are quite a few here now. I was imprinted with the gospel as a child, running free in my dad's little acre in East Mill Creek, Salt Lake City. It was our little food chain during the Depression, and we never felt deprived. We had fresh fruit and veggies, meat from the calf or pig that Dad killed each year. We drank milk from Daisy and Buttercup. From my mother, Lavinia Mitchell Lithgow, I inherited a love of the printed word and love of arts. From my father, Leo Thomas Lithgow, I inherited a love for work and the great outdoors. From them both, the love of the gospel of Jesus Christ came to me as a gift. Neither one of my parents went beyond 10th grade, but they supported their children in whatever they chose to do. From my classes in school to the dances at church, I found that I loved books and stories. In grade school, I gathered my fans and read my stories during recess while others played kickball. I sensed that the parables of Jesus and the stories in the Bible were more convincing than the doctrines. The fact that I have not fulfilled my dream of becoming a fiction writer is partly that it was educated out of me, and partly that the stories of people I know seem more exciting than anything I could dream up. I kept a diary from age 13 to 22, so I can prove that those years were filled with delightful experiences, encouraging teachers, loyal friends, and church leaders who seemed devoted to my development. The grand reward was where I learned to give a speech, teach a lesson, write and act in plays and skits, and to 10 children. My two younger brothers, Tom and Dennis, and my late arriving sister, Gay, were my companions. My wholesome life moved on to the University of Utah, where I signed up for classes at the Institute of Religion under Lowell Brennan, Ed Lyon, and George Boyd. Those dovetailed with my classes across the street. I remember thinking, this is a charmed life. I want to write about it someday. I echo Laura Ulrich's word in the commencement speech she gave here when she said her life was anchored by William Mulder at the university and Lowell Bannon across the street. Hats off to them and the other fine professors who helped me graduate with an MA in English. They gave me the skills for a lifetime of learning. They used the Socratic method of asking meaningful questions. It was more important than answers. Brother Benny used to come in and write on the board, "What is your philosophy of life?" We shallow students had no idea what that meant. We parroted what we had heard in Sunday school. But Lowell wouldn't accept that. We had to go on, we had to ask questions about ourselves and about others and what our life was like. He didn't like the method of teaching, which he described as, "What am I thinking?" A teacher would say that, and you're supposed to guess what he's thinking. Life is not a huge Jeopardy game where our leaders peg answers at us while we try to read their minds. My first full-time professional job took me to BYU, where I taught English with another group of creative thinkers. Leonard Rice, chair of the English department, Bruce Clark, Ralph Rich, Jeanette Morrell, D. Stephen Olakay's niece, Rodden Clark, Ed Hart, Clinton Larson. Those are only the few of the wonderful people there who stimulated my mind and made me feel at home. But I was unhappy in the ward. I was a special interest. Any of you remember what that was? What that is? It was a word for single in those days. And I was only 25. So they called me to the job of assistant roll taker in one of the many gospel doctrine classes. And I was teaching English in BYU. So I took to traveling to Salt Lake every Sunday, so Salt Lakers thought I was going to church in Provo, and Provo thought I was going to church in Salt Lake. I was going inactive and didn't really realize it. Fortunately, I began to date a young man I had known for 7 years at the U. He was now teaching economics at BYU and continued to work on a PhD from Harvard, Charles Henry Bradford, a noted chick. We had similar backgrounds, the same worldview. We did hold slightly different political views. He a Republican, I a Democrat. But that was before today's polarization into blues and reds. We blended well. We were purple. Note that as soon as we were married, I was called to be a gospel doctrine teacher. So you adopt your auntie right away. We accepted with alacrity the chance to work for Senator Wallace Bennett in the Congress of the United States. What a great adventure. Marriage saved me from inactivity. I throw the drawing up. This. Every time I come here, everything dries up. It's so dry. So we moved to Washington. We thought it was a grand adventure. Marriage saved me from inactivity and plunged me into the vortex of child rearing and other activities. The Arlington ward became the village that took over my rearing. The first ward in Virginia, it had an impressive history as a modern pioneer group. The founders actually built the chapel with their own hands. We became part of a close group of young couples who raised their children together, and because our parents were not nearby, we were family to each other. The church was strong in D.C., and we decided to stay, even through dire warnings from the West, who tried to convince us of the impossibility of rearing active Mormon children in the East, quote, unquote. Some expected us to return home to Zion at any moment, but we believed that Zion was wherever we were. When Jean England and Wes Johnson founded a dialogue in 1966, I immediately volunteered. This was being anxiously engaged in a good cause of our own free will, a principle I was taught in my youth. The church house organs couldn't print all the fine work we wanted to write. Dialogue put me back in touch with my former friends and colleagues in school. It was an exciting venture at a yeasty time when all kinds of issues were waiting to be questioned. Jean England started me out on my career as a personal essayist by asking me to write for a section of Dialogue. I had no idea that 10 years later I would become Dialogue's first woman editor at a time when the women's movement was heating up in this country. I have to thank Bob Rees for roping me into the job. He remains my friend and brother. I was already in my 40s and still wonderfully naive. Imagine my surprise upon learning that my voice, speaking from within my own cozy cocoon, was now an alternate voice. When I traveled to Salt Lake to keep an appointment with Dean Larson, the church historian who had served the mission with my brother, he refused to see me. I will not talk to the editor of Dialogue. I was also turned down as a speaker at BYU Women's Conference by Dallin Oaks, We can't have just anybody speaking here. I knew him. He had written for Dialogue. An editor at the Ensign informed me that had he known I was to become Dialogue editor, my article about the Washingtonian Mormons would not have been published. It is now in the cornerstone of the Washington Temple. I couldn't understand this kind of behavior and still don't. Why can't leaders sit down and discuss with members the issues that tend to divide us? I worked with a well-grounded board of editors on as my chairman Dialogue, and the staff to whom nothing was too small or too large. We were all proud of the history of Mormons in D.C., and we had an unusually creative and energetic group. Most of those had reverse tracked from shelters in the West. During the years 76 to 82, the blacks received the priesthood. The church became ever more international. Sonia Johnson was excommunicated. Important intellectual history came to light. Although Camelot under Leonard Arrington closed down, groundbreaking articles kept coming out anyway. We celebrated the church during its sesquicentennial in Dialogue. We published the first papers of MHA and the Association of Mormon Letters. We cooperated with other publications like Sunstone and Exponent, exchanging articles and advice. This was all exciting work. I wasn't going to leave. Why would I leave? My bishop husband was running the ward upstairs. I was doing Dialogue downstairs. And during this period, my children grew up. One of them, luckily, is here tonight. He's a professor of economics at BYU, and he's coming to live in Washington for a year to be near his mommy. When we moved to Journal to Utah in 1982, under the Newells and Levine, it was on strong footing. We knew it would last at least 4 years, and by darn it has. Be 4 years old next year. After that, I was entrusted with the life of my mentor and teacher, Lowell Banion, and thanks to Dialogue and the editing and advice from wonderful friends, I was able to publish it in 1995 before he passed on. Once a reporter asked Esther Peterson, that great and famous activist from Utah, what advice she would give young women who wanted to have a career in public service. She answered, marry the right man. I married a man who was devoted to my welfare. His unfailing support of everything I tried to do was a pillar of my faith. When he died in 1991, all of my villages came together to help me through it. Fortunately, my three children, Steve, Lorraine, and Scott, along with their 12 children later on, of course, have inherited all of Chick's fine qualities. When I'm with them, I don't miss him as much. Chick suffered from a form of MD, but he somehow turned his disability into an ability. He had the ability to inspire others to do their best work. When they saw how faithful he was in all his duties, you know it was a great struggle just to get up from the chair. They said, if he can do it, so can I. Brother Bunyan used to teach us about joy has been a quality that's very important to our lives. And it wasn't just a simple fun and games or recreation. It was a deep satisfaction that came from suffering along with learning. And I think that I learned this when Chick died, the wonderful outpouring of joy from his friends and family. sustained us all. And I was able to say afterwards, you know, that was kind of fun. A large group of friends and family gathered around his bed and sang him into the next life. His birthday was the day he died. My morning labor took me to Ireland, that green grieving land, with strong women friends. One of these, Sue Paxman, former editor of Exponent 2, decided to settle in Ireland. As Sue Booth Forbes, she opened a writer and artist retreat in a little paradise in Southwest Cork, where I have worked on my writing and my healing. Sue was one of the many women friends who stayed with me through my darkness and light. They had given me advice and shelter, laughed me out of depression, have helped me rear my children and publish my work. My wide circle is not composed entirely of women. Besides the mentors and colleagues I have already mentioned, a long line of men have opened doors to friendship and understanding. It gives a lie to the belief that men and women cannot be true friends. I know this is not true. Now I believe I'm living in my last village. 3 years ago, I sold my house in Arlington, moved 20 miles away to a retirement community near my daughter. What I thought would be peaceful old age devoted to writing and reading proved to be as challenging as my other villages. I'm suddenly an old widow in a young married church. I'm actually the oldest woman in my ward. Shades of special interest. If ever I would leave the old church of my childhood, it would be because of the boredom and the feeling of being separate, outsider in your own church. And this experience reminds me of going to Provo and going back and forth between the cities. So it's a challenge to me to figure out how to stay when I like to run out into the parking lot and talk to people. When I was born, I got pneumonia 3 weeks. My mother wrote in her diary that Brother Bishop Howard came by and blessed me. I was turning blue. The doctor had given up. So she said I was a miracle baby. And when I got older, I realized so was everyone else. Life is a miracle. And it taught me that prayers would really make a big difference. So when my mother got pneumonia when she was about 40, I needed to take my brothers to the other room and pray because this was a crisis. And she got better. I stood up in sacrament meeting and told her how my prayers had saved my brother's life. So when I became pregnant with my firstborn, Stephen, Chick arranged for me to meet with Apostle Lee. And he blessed me that my baby would be free of the MD that he had suffered from. When 16 years later, it was diagnosed in Stephen, I had a strange reaction. I recalled that Brother Brennan's favorite scripture was from Micah. What does the Lord require of thee but to do justly, to love mercy, to walk humbly with that God? From this, I assumed that justice and mercy were primary qualities and that we should be humble in recognizing that God would walk with us, not ahead of us or behind us, but with us. There is something satisfying in knowing that God would not and could not intervene in the progress of this inherited disease that had already struck generations of worthy Bradfords. That left the fact that our worthy child would have to suffer. We had to deal with the water going on, and I had to quit talking. Last paragraph. that we had said that there's nothing that much could be done about this disease, so I took Steve to a specialist, a woman doctor who seemed to know every case in America. She told him, look at your father. He's your example of what you can accomplish. She recommended a physical therapist. As I sat in the waiting room in deep despond, thinking, if only I could have the disease myself, a shaft of light suddenly sliced the dingy air. A still small voice in my head said, he will carry this burden himself. Then he walked into the room smiling. Mom, there is something I can do. On the way home he said, Mom, I want you to know that I believe I chose you in the pre-existence, and I would do so again. At that moment I knew that if God had not eradicated the disease, he had given us a great blessing, a son as courageous and faithful as his father. When I asked Steve for permission to tell a story, he said, that like Father Charles, I have a wife with tremendous faith who loves me. I can bear this burden in exchange for that and my three children. If I have often placed my faith in the harm of flesh, it is because flesh has never failed me. God's greater creation is a human personality. My experience bears that out. Thank you.
I express, I think, the gratitude of all of us here to the five participants for, to use Fred's phrase, this fast and testimony meeting that he can't have at home. Thank you all for attending.